All right. Friends, you're listening to Irish Radio Network USA. I'm delighted to welcome Larry Kerwin from Wexford, an immigrant like myself, and indeed we have other things in common because Larry hosts a program, Celtic Crush, on Sirius XM Radio that airs every Sunday morning from 9 until 12 noon when a lot of us are at Mass. I mean, Larry, very welcome.
Thank you so much, Adrian. Good to hear your voice.
I just want to ask you, though, about the program and Celtic Crush and how you got into it and, in fact, how did you develop a massive audience, by the way. What was your impetus?
Well, it happened really by accident. This week is the 12th anniversary of the show. I was up at SiriusXM because at that point I was in Black 47, and we had a new album out at the time, an album and a memoir that I wrote. The memoir is called Green Suede Shoes.
Yes.
And the album was called Elvis Murphy's Green Suede Shoes. And I was doing an interview with a friend of mine up there. Meg Griffith was her name. And we always laugh a lot when we talk because we go way back. And I was standing in the corridor with her afterwards, and we were just laughing and talking. And one of the big bosses, who I didn't know at the time, from SiriusXM was walking by. And he heard my accent, and he called her over and said, "We need someone to do a Celtic-themed show. Can this guy talk?" And she said, "Pour a couple of drinks in and he'll never shut him up."
Yeah, can a cat drink milk? Yeah.
Exactly. And that was it. The next week, they brought me in, and, you know, I'd done a lot of radio interviews, but I'd never done it from the other side.
Yes.
And basically, Meg sat in with me in the studio, and we came up with a format, which would be we'd play three songs in sequence, and then I would talk about the songs or talk about whatever came into my mind. So then it developed more into a music and a kind of a talk show.
Yes.
And occasionally I would bring in guests. And the reason the show got so popular, I think, was because at that point there was Sirius and there was XM. There were
two separate
channels, and both satellite channels. And then they merged. So I got all the – I had already established a reputation on Sirius, and then I got all the XM people too. And it's the only really Celtic-themed show there on the on the whole channel, on the whole station.
Now, so, Celtic incorporates Irish, but not exclusively Irish. That's also that's one for the Guinness Book, because there's rarely, if there is another one, I don't know about it. But actually taking Celtic music and common roots, Celtic roots, it definitely does, you know, widen an already overwhelming, a reservoir of, in fact, Celtic music. There's a lot of it out there, you know.
There's a lot, and then I extended there are eight Celtic nations, but then I extended it to anybody who is playing music who is of a Celtic background. So then it's not exclusively just Celtic music. It could be rock-themed music, or it could be anything, as long as the person has some Celtic connection. And in that way, the panorama is vast, really, you know. So, but basically, they let me alone. That was the great thing. So like yourself, the way you run your own show and produce it, basically from that moment on, they said, you know, you're getting good ratings. that's one less problem we have to deal with, and go for it. So I don't really have anyone overseeing me. So whatever way I wanted to run it, if I wanted to get political, I could do that. If I, you know, whatever I felt like doing. So
I just want to mark your card. Try to steer clear of our mutual friend Malachy McCourt. He's done his lever best to get me off the air for so many years, and still, you know, like the horse running back to the burning barn, he's still a great radio guest. Let me ask you about Black 47, and again, the introduction of now an Irish American rock band. That goes back almost three decades. That was a bit bold as well, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. You see, at that point, all Irish-American bands pretty much were looking back at Ireland.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas to me, you know, and I loved all the bands that were in Ireland at the time. There was the Saw Doctors and the Waterboys and Christy Moore and everything. But Chris Byrne, who formed Black 47 with me, and we had a different idea. We said, we're living in the greatest city of the world. We're living in the city of Bob Dylan and Miles Davis and hip-hop and punk and funk and all these things. So why not do Irish music through that prism rather than just through the prism of Ireland?
Right.
Why not take all those influences in? And you see, originally when we went to the Bronx, Chris and I thought, there's all these new Irish up there. They were called the New Irish that time. This is 1989.
Yes.
And so we thought that they would gravitate towards us because we were doing original music. But they didn't like us really at all that much. But what did happen was that Irish American youths really liked the band. And because we were the first band, it kind of spoke for them and what their issues were.
Right.
So we hit a market without even realizing we were hitting it, because Chris being Irish-American and me being a long-time Irish immigrant in New York, someone who had been illegal, by the way, too. So, you know, we had an audience without even realizing it.
Yes. And when you say your stuff, you know, your music was original, a lot of that music, you know, and lyrics between, you know, Chris Byrne and yourself, it was original and it was as parochial and yet had an international, had a national and international flavor. But it was new, and I'm sure a lot of the established community at the time would have paid scant attention to it and say, well, okay, maybe that's for somebody else. But you did build up a rather broad audience through the years at festivals, and you've traveled the United States and beyond. You know, and again, holding on to your original mission, and so you definitely cut a new track, as it were, excusing the pun. But you did establish that, and I suppose with everything else, the image and the makeup of Black 47. Could not have continued any longer than you did. It was extremely demanding, and it was not just your appeal was not just local, but right across the vast country of the U.S.
Yeah, we were trying to be original all the time. We didn't see any point in copying anyone else. You know, we had a lot of different influences. We had vast amount of influences, but it just never occurred to us to imitate anyone else. So we always were independent too. We didn't take advice. which is probably a good thing in ways. But so we had to invent everything as we went along, and you learn a lot by that. You know, after 5-10 years of being on the road, you get wise to different things. But at the same time, you know, we had a set of political principles too, and we stuck to that always.
Yeah.
And I think even when people wouldn't agree with us on certain things, they realized we were sincere about what we were doing. So that's fine with a lot of people. I think what people don't like is if they sense that someone is being dishonest in some way. You know, then you can accept a lot if you think, well, I don't agree with them, but, you know, I like the melodies. Some people didn't like the words, you know, but we might, you know, a couple of guys in the band didn't care for or didn't even think in terms of the lyrics. They were pure musicians, you know, they were there because we improvised everything. We did 2,500 gigs in 25 years, and we never did the same set twice. You know, every night it was a different set that I would write up before we went along. And after 3 or 4 songs, I might get tired of that set even and just head off someplace else, you know, depending on who felt a particular thing on that night within the band, you know, musically or lyrically or whatever, you know.
You know, chicken and the egg, you became and you are the board president of the Irish-American Writers and Artists. Tell us about that. I know they have a very star-studded membership, but how did that get off the ground?
That actually got off the ground when it was suggested back in when Barack Obama ran first for president. It was suggested that Irish Americans would never vote for a black candidate.
Uh-huh.
And a group of us got together and made a statement that that wasn't the case and, you know, elaborated on it. And then we pooled our money together and we bought ads in the Irish Voice and the Irish Echo. And that was the starting point. And out of that came the organization. And Malachy, as you were saying, was one of the prime early movers and still is. Peter Quinn, who wrote Banished Children of Eve and is a great historian, he was the first president. And TJ was the second, and I'm the third. I was the one left standing at that point. So I'm not sure I deserved the position, but I was the one who was left there at that point. And
let me ask you, though, about who are your members and what is the scope? Writers and artists,
and musicians.
You know, musicians. So it is more than it is a very inclusive group. Even if you're not a writer, I know that you have a great number of members who, in fact, just like to be in that atmosphere, without feeling any pressure to contribute their own, writings or whatever. But it also has a great social aspect to it.
It does. Well, what we do is twice a month we have salons where the members get together and in a rotating order we'll have maybe 10 people present their work for, you know, 8 minutes or 10 minutes, something like that, slots like that. So, as you say, there are many writers, artists, musicians, filmmakers, whatever, in there. And you don't have to be Irish, by the way, either.
Right.
But there are also people who just like being in that kind of a
circle,
a mix,
and
to appreciate that. So twice a month we have free salons where anybody can come. And membership is $50 a year, so it's like less than a dollar a week.
Yes.
And then we have all sorts of other social events. And any money that's raised, we give out to different charities, and or we support other arts organizations like the Irish Arts Center, the Irish Rep, and we hold concerts and things for famine relief and for earthquake relief, or if we see a cause of some sort that we like. Basically, we raise a good bit of money in the course of the year, but at the end of the year, it's all gone. We spend it on something.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Now, nobody within the organization gets paid, so 100% of the money goes to charity or towards underwriting these salons. And
okay, just to how do people find out more about it, or is there a phone number, a website? Is there?
Yeah, there's a website, Irish American Writers and Artists. If you just put that in Google or whatever,
Google is, and that's it.
You'll get the whole thing. Or if you're on Facebook, there's a vibrant Facebook page, Irish American Writers and Artists.
Yeah. Now you have, this is not your first play. You've always dabbled in your many areas of arts. You have, though, a play currently running at the Irish Repertory Theatre, and where it's being presented, it was the world premiere of Larry Kerwin's Rebel in the Soul, which is directed by Charlotte Moore, who's co-founder of the Irish Rep, and it's playing right through May 21st. Now, we were, we saw that the other night, and whereas we knew probably sketchy or had sketchy information with respect to a rebel at the time, Dr. Noel Brown, who was elected to the Irish Parliament back in 1948, the youngest, he became the youngest minister at the time, but somebody who actually had a life-changing influence in an Ireland which many of us, if we were not directly affected, definitely our parents and their generation, many of those died in hindsight unnecessarily from the scourge of tuberculosis, TB, which to a large extent was, I won't say ignored, but it was considered insurmountable by the Irish government and, in fact, the Irish Church until Noel Brown came along. Maybe you can pick it up from there.
Yeah, well, you're so right, Adrian, that it touched so many people, tuberculosis, and it was considered incurable in many ways because people didn't understand it, that it was passed. Ireland was a really poor country, as you will remember from growing up. We tend to forget that now, and people lived in very close quarters together. So it was very easy if someone in the family contracted tuberculosis, it was spread to other members so easily. I was just noticing something about myself the other day, that I don't like to be in a room sometimes when without a window opening. And I got that from my parents. They always liked to have a bit of a window open because it was letting in the fresh air. And I think that came pretty much from the fear of tuberculosis. So it was rampant in the country. And Dr. Noel Brown was born in 1915. And he was born to a pretty poor family. And his father worked for the Cruelty to Children organization, if mm-hmm. you remember that.
Yeah.
And he contracted tuberculosis from going to very poor homes. He came back with it, infected his wife and at least three of his children. So he died when Brown was 10.
Mm-hmm.
No, when he was about 8. And he had already given it to his wife, and then his wife died when Brown was
yeah.
10. So they had a daughter Brown had a sister who had gotten some work in England. The only thing the mother could do was take the family over to the eldest sister, and she died within days of them arriving. So Brown is homeless. Everyone, they're all homeless, living in England, and the employer of the daughter who had the job, they took in the family. And so Brown had this amazing stroke of luck in that he was very smart, and the family recognized that, and they got him a scholarship to a very posh English prep school. And while in there, he became friends with someone else in the school who took him back on vacation to Ireland, and they took him in there, a very prominent Anglo-Irish rich family. So all of a sudden, Brown became this very well-off guy, even though he was a pauper in England, but he had this drive that he was going to cure tuberculosis. So he went to Trinity College, became a doctor, and went to England, worked there, and then came back and worked in sanitariums in Ireland, and Plan Republica, the Irish party, was formed in 1947, and they asked Brown to run. Sean McBride was the leader of it. They asked Brown to run for election. He did, and on his first day in Parliament, it was the coalition government of 1948, and Brown was appointed Minister for Health, and he was 33 at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And he became a kind of a dictator in that he took whatever money he could from a lot of it from the Irish Hospital sweepstakes, and he invested it in sanitariums around Ireland and insisted that anyone who had tuberculosis had to go into the sanitarium and be kept away from his family, and the government would support the families.
Right.
And within 3 years, he had cut back on tuberculosis totally in Ireland. And within 15 years after that, tuberculosis was pretty much eradicated from Ireland, and it's thankfully still
yes.
gone. While he was in, though, he realized that a lot of children were dying from diphtheria and gastroenteritis. And he introduced a bill into Parliament saying that any pregnant woman could get free health care, and every child could get free health care up to the age of 16. So he tried to do the same thing as he had been doing for tuberculosis, but he ran into opposition from Archbishop John Charles McQuaid of Dublin,
mm-hmm.
who is kind of afraid of the idea of the government getting involved in family care, probably because he figured eventually that might lead to contraception or even abortion.
Yeah,
so there was a big mm-hmm. battle between Brown and McQuaid, and Dr. Sean McBride, whom I very much admired, didn't stand up for Brown when he should have.
No. Well, he had his own agenda and his own problems in that
exactly.
here he, you know, and his party had ousted, you know, the De Valera party, and his claim to fame was that he was, you know, the ex-Irish Republican Army chief.
Right.
You know, and whereas he definitely supported and solicited the young Dr. Noel Brown and was had admiration for his, you know, his goal to rid Ireland of TB. He also did not appreciate the fact, I think he had a better read on the grip that the church had, you know, on Ireland, on the people of Ireland, and on the government of Ireland.
Yeah, he read the wind well, and it led to a constitutional crisis, and Brown had to resign over it. So I was always aware of this and aware of the story that was there. So basically what I just got into the whole thing and then reimagined what might have happened. But people call this a docudrama, but it's not. It's there's nothing in the play was actually said by the characters officially. I just reimagined how they might have dealt with each other. And at the same time, to try and portray a reasonable portrait of Archbishop McQuaid too.
Yeah.
You know, to show what he was really like rather than as a figure he was painted, because they were all people of their times, you know, and the three of them got caught in this bind that they didn't really mean to get into. You know, when you get into a situation, yeah, there's time ticking away, and the three of them made mistakes, you know, and that led to the crisis. So that's what I reimagined in this play, is not what actually happened, but what I reimagined what happened. It has the same beginning and the same end as the actual facts, but within the play, I take liberties in a way of exploring the three characters and seeing what they were really like, you know, or how I imagined they were like.
Well, many would say that it was spot on, because I think many of us grew up hearing, you know, about the fear and the scourge of TB. And then as we emigrated from Ireland, both of us, we then came across people here who had actually not escaped you know, the inheritance of TB. How many, you know, doctors and how many people in the United States who came from Ireland were discovering for the first time that they had actually previously some degree of this horrific disease.
Yes.
A latent kind of smidgen of it, but it was definitely there. So
it was definitely there, yeah. It's amazing how many people have gotten in touch with me since the play got some publicity to say either that Brown was a saint, you know, that he cured someone in their family and they would be forever grateful to them,
yeah,
or people, and fairly young people, who still have that smidgen of tuberculosis, found out about it through, you know, going to a college where they had to take a test or something, you know.
Right.
Or to sports, a lot of people found out about it.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's Brown was a unique man. But what I tried to do in the play too is capture his arrogance and his,
yeah,
dictatorial way of dealing with things. He was a hard man to deal with. I mean, I was a supporter of his, but I watched him at different times, and he was a difficult man. You know?
Right, and if I may make a, you know, a personal commentary, if you had to get an actor to portray Dr. John Charles McQuaid, Archbishop of Dublin, you couldn't have picked anybody better, you know, than John Keating. Oh my God,
yeah.
It's good. It's educational. It is. It's going to revive a lot of memories of an era, like indeed the famine, or for many people, you know, 1916, that has been, you know, kind of brushed over.
Yeah.
But this one, many people living today, and many people whose parents came would know very little about the true story, which you have adapted into, you know, Rebel in the Soul. It is playing at the Irish Repertory Theatre now until May 21st. Well worth seeing. And I can say that, friends, the best way to see what your options are in terms of when and where would be to log on to irishrep.org or call 212-727-2737. My guest, Larry Kerwin, founder and leader of Black 47, board president of the Irish American Writers and Artists, the host and creator, indeed, of Celtic Crush on Sirius XM Radio, and indeed a playwright with now a very stirring and poignant play, Rebel in the Soul. Congratulations and wish you lots of luck. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Adrian. Appreciate it. Take care of yourself.
Okay, you too. And friends, you're listening to Irish Radio Network, USA.